Good night to everybody. Today, we're going to learn, actually, what's written over there, 13 principles of faith. What's actually, what do Jews believe on? This is what we're going to learn. And God willing, it's going to not, I mean, it's not going to be difficult. It's not really difficult concepts. There's a lot of information we can talk about. So I'm just going to present information, and then we can discuss what's really going on. Let's go. First of all, the main source we're going to learn these ideas from is called the Rambam. Rambam is actually the letters of Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon. You can see them over there in the screen. He was born in Spain. He passed away in Egypt. And those are the years he lived on. That means a few years ago. He was a very interesting character in Judaism itself. He was a rabbi, doctor, philosopher. Okay, that's like what everybody knows. But the point is that when he wrote as a rabbi, as a doctor, as a philosopher, everything together, everything like mixed in together. So you can find in his writings all kinds of ideas. Again, like he can talk to you about food, what's the proper food to eat. He can talk to you about the laws of Judaism. He can talk to you about really deep ideas. So he wrote many, many things. The most famous are Guide for the Perplexed. It's called Moed HaNevuchim in Hebrew. That was a book written for a certain students that were deviating themselves from Judaism into Aristotelic philosophy. So he wrote a whole book, very complex book. The most of people don't really learn the whole book. You just use it as a reference. The Rambam says in this particular part, okay, so you go and read that particular part and that's it. It's a very, very, very complicated book, Guide for the Perplexed. Then he wrote a comment, actually, first, he wrote a commentary on the Mishnah. The Mishnah is the main body of the oral law. And even though his commentary is not the most famous one, but it's one of those printed at the back, in the back of every single Talmud edition. You have the commentary of the Rambam on the Mishnah. He wrote it when he was young. And then he wrote the Mishneh Torah. This is the main work that he wrote, that it comprises all the laws of Judaism. One of the greatest things on this book is that he wrote, I repeat, all the laws. Everybody in his times and after him also, only wrote those laws that were actually practical. Like, we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, a temple in Jerusalem. We want one, and the third one is going to be built by Mashiach speedily in our days. Okay, but today we don't have it. And if today we don't have it, in the days of the Rambam, of course, we didn't have it. So most of the halachic authorities did not really delve into those laws because anyway, they were not practical. So what do you need them for? But the Rambam wrote each one in each single law that pertains to the whole things, the whole Judaism. Now, the part of the book that we're going to learn is a very small part of the commentary on the Mishnah. The Mishnah is a big book also, important book to learn. God willing, sometime we're going to delve into some Mishnayos, whatever. But the Mishnah itself is comprised of six orders, and within those orders, there are tractates. One of the tractates is called Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin is like a court of law. That's what it means. It was a group of people, sometimes 71, sometimes 23, sometimes 7, sometimes 3. For different kinds of cases, you put different numbers of judges. But the point is that Sanhedrin talks about all the cases that can have testifying people, how do you test the testimonies, the witnesses, and how do you select the judges, what do you do with them, etc., etc., all kinds of things. There's one chapter within this tractate, within this order of this book called Mishnah. We went from down up. One chapter, order, a tractate, which is comprised of many chapters, within the order of the Mishnah. One chapter of Sanhedrin that talks about basically the world to come. Not necessarily what's going to happen, but who actually goes into the world to come. later on, not now. Later on, we're going to discuss what's this idea of world to come, but not now. We're going to talk about this later. The point is that there's, again, one chapter that talks about the world to come. And one of the, not main themes of the chapter, but one of the things that appear in the chapter is about people that are actually heretics. This means people that don't believe in Judaism, people that don't believe in the world to come, people that don't believe in the laws, in the rabbis, kinds of things. And since this chapter of this book called Mishnah talks about this issue, the Rambam has a whole introduction into this chapter. Besides explaining the laws, he first of all says, okay, wait a second. If we're going to define somebody that for some reason does not have a share in the world to come, so to speak, quote unquote, so to speak, not to be misunderstood, like God says, you, I don't want you with me, no way. So we have to understand what brings a person to be considered into that category. Why would a person be considered into such a category? And to explain that, the Rambam says, I'm going to explain what Judaism is all about. There are 13 principles that every single Jew, man, women, doesn't make any difference, has to believe on. We're going to explain them, patience. And if a person does not believe in one of these 13 principles, oh, that's a heretic. He doesn't have a share in the world to come. He doesn't have a part in the world to come. Okay, and then after you have the whole introduction of what are the principles of Judaism, so now you can understand, now we can understand what the chapter talks about. This guy doesn't have a part of the world to come. This other guy doesn't have a part of the world to come, and so on. But again, to do that, the Rambam explains what's Judaism all about. Are we going to learn laws of Judaism? The answer is no. This class is not about laws. This class is not about details either. We're not going to learn all the details of all the commandments because it would take us years. No way. We're just going to learn main ideas, basically the fundamental ideas of Judaism, that if a person, for some reason, for any reason, does not believe in any of these ideas, we have a problem. We have a big problem. This is what we're going to do. Now, before doing that, after this small introduction of who was the Rambam and what he wrote, etc., etc., I think it's proper to know that not everybody agrees to these 13 principles. What does that mean? Not that they negate that they are important things, etc. No, but rather, if you're going to talk to me about fundamentals, okay, wait a second. When you make a building, when you build actually a building, there are certain things that are called the basic things of the building, the fundaments of the building. And there are certain things that are not called fundaments of the building. Like, for instance, if you want a couch in your room, that's okay, but that's not a fundamental thing in the building. A building sustains and works and functions, etc., without a couch also. You like couches? Go buy a couch for yourself. That's okay, but that's not a fundamental. So the Rambam is saying, we're going to learn this, there are 13 principles. Others say, no, wait a second, there are not 13. For instance, Rav Chasdai Crescas, that was his name. He lived also in Spain. You can see the years when he lived. He says there are 6 principles. The other things that the Rambam says, okay, are important things, no doubt. And we should believe on them, etc., etc. But fundamentals, no, there are only 6. And furthermore, Rav Yosef Albo, which actually he was a student of Rav Chasdai Crescas, he even argues with his own teacher and said there are only 3 principles to Judaism. Now, even so, I mean, even though we have different opinions, for some reason, I don't know exactly why, don't ask me, the 13 principles that the Rambam explained, those principles became famous. And even there are certain sidurim, certain books of prayer of Judaism that people actually, they say these 13 principles every day. I believe on this, I believe on that. I mean, they actually said there's a song also built around the 13 principles. Yigdal Elokim Chai Veishtabach. It's a whole song. I'm not going to go into the song. I don't know the song because I don't. In the Chabad Sidur, in the Chabad prayer book, we don't have these 13 principles. But whatever. So for some reason, those 13 became famous. But I thought it was important at least to know that some other authorities, philosophical authorities, they see it somewhat different, which doesn't mean that it's whatever we're going to see, it's wrong. No, everybody agrees that anything that we're going to learn, it's the proper Jewish thinking. Are there fundamentals? Are they fundamentals or not? Okay, we can argue, but this is the proper Jewish thinking. Okay, let's go. Principle number one. The Rambam says, and I actually underline it, so to speak, knowledge of this existence of a God. We can talk about hours about what a God is. Okay, the Rambam also explains this in Mishneh Torah, in the first chapters. He explains what do we mean when we say God. I'm not going to go into that. The main thing I want to go into is, again, you have to know that there's a God. Usually people say, you have to have faith. Like, do you see God? No, I don't see. And whatever, if a person says that he sees God, he's going to end up in a psych ward probably, not in a class of Torah. But the fact is that the Rambam doesn't say you have to have faith that there's a God. You have to know. Why? Because there's a huge difference between faith and knowledge. It's not the same thing. Faith applies to things that the intellect cannot reach. Certain things you can see, actually. So you don't even need intellect for those things. You can see them, you can touch them, etc. Certain things you don't see. So you can think about them, and you're going to reach a conclusion, an intellectual conclusion that particular thing is true or not, whatever the case is. But there are certain things that don't make any sense. When we talk about God, the existence of God makes sense to the intellect. There are a few ideas we can share about this, but the main idea is, philosophically speaking, a material thing does not make itself. If there's a material thing, that means that something else made that thing. Things just don't pop up and start being just out of nothing. So if there's a world, and it's a material world that we can see and we can touch, etc., etc., that means there's a creator. It's like a logical conclusion. Do we understand what the creator is? No, that's not logical. That's faith. Faith applies to things we cannot understand, and not because I'm stupid. So, okay, Tuvia doesn't understand. Okay, how much is 1 + 1? I don't really know. Okay, poor Tuvia. He doesn't know how much is 1 + 1. No, I'm not saying this. You can be very smart, super smart. Even so, there are things we don't understand. And even the intellect is conscious that there are certain things that the intellect cannot understand, like the idea of infinity. You can ask the most developed scientist in the world, define, tell me what infinity is. There's no way to understand it in our finite mind. And that's not a problem. That's okay. But again, even logically speaking, the intellect itself understands there are things that we cannot understand. That's where faith comes into the picture, so to speak. But the Rambam, again, the Rambam says the first principle of Judaism is to know that there's a God. Just give me a second. Not now. Okay, I'm sorry. This is the first idea, knowledge of the existence of a God. The Rama goes further. This existence is not just like you and me. It's a complete existence. What does that mean, a complete existence? That doesn't have any kind of limitation at all. Not limitation on space. Not limitation of time, as we're going to explain later also, what does it mean, space, time, etc. And the idea of completeness of this existence that is God is that everything depends on him, God, to exist. But he doesn't depend on anything else to exist. That means even, God forbid, we say that the world doesn't exist and nothing else exists, God doesn't stop existing. He doesn't depend on us, but we depend on him. That's what it means in the words of the Rambam in a different book, whatever, Mishneh Torah. That's what it means, a true existence. True existence means he is the only one that is really independent of anything else. We depend on him. Okay. For most, not for all of them, but for most of the principles, the Rambam brings a verse. Where do you see this idea? Even, I'm not going to read it to you because it doesn't make any sense, but in one of the principles, I forgot exactly which one. We can look it up later if you need. But in one of the principles, the Rambam says, I'm not here to tell you all the verses where these ideas are. But the truth is that for most of the principles, he brings a verse, a pasuk, to say, look, you want to know where this is found? How do you learn this? Why am I saying this is a principle? Because the Torah says, I'm God your Lord. The first command, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I'm God your Lord. So that means that we can somehow relate to him, intellectually speaking. Again, I'm not saying we understand what he is, what God is. No, we don't understand. And we're never going to understand until Mashiach comes and God is going to be revealed, etc., etc. But we can know that he exists. Yes, this is the first principle. Know that God exists and that his existence is complete. Absolutely complete. Let's go. Principle number two, the oneness of God. What does it mean, oneness of God? It doesn't mean that there's just one God. No. It's a lot deeper than this, but the Rambam doesn't go into the deepness of each concept because, let's not forget, he's not writing a book on these ideas. No. He's bringing these ideas as an introduction to understand something else. So his main point in this place where he writes these ideas is not really explaining the deepness of Judaism. No. He wants to explain what a heretic means, who doesn't have a place in the world to come, a peace or whatever, a part in the world to come, who does have, etc. But he wants to bring these principles. That's why actually it's a very short text for most of the principles, but are deep ideas. Oneness of God. What does it mean, oneness of God? Again, philosophically speaking, intellectually speaking, God is one, but it's not one as a couple. Like when you see a couple, you have man and woman, or whatever, husband and wife. It's one couple, yeah, but it's composed of two components. So the Rambam says, forget it. That's not God. It's not composed of two components. And it's not one like in species. We say the species of cats. Okay, cat, there's a cat. When you say cat, that actually includes all the cats in the world. They're basically, quote unquote, all the same. They are cats and they're dogs. Yes, but actually, when you talk about cats, you are talking about millions. I don't know the number of cats in the world. I don't care either. It's okay. But there are millions of cats going around in the world. So even though you're talking about the cat, yeah, but it actually includes many, many individuals into that category called cat or dog or whatever the case. So God is not like that. It's not one, but actually there are many individuals. No. God doesn't have any parts. The Rambam also emphasizes this. It's not composed of different components. Not at all. His oneness is something that we cannot really understand. And one more point that maybe I didn't emphasize this enough, but these are principles of faith. After all, again, let's go back just for a second to the first principle. We say, okay, you have to know the existence of God. But what God is? Now that's faith. Forget it. And for the second principle, basically the same idea applies. Okay, God is one. Yeah, very nice. You can intellectually also reach the conclusion that God is one. He cannot be two. Because we're going to see later, he doesn't have a body. Okay, but the point is that do we really understand the oneness of God? No, that's something that goes into the category of faith. What's the verse where we learn that God is one? So the Rambam also quotes a verse, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, hear Israel, God, etc. God is one. So that, there we have second principle. Let's go for a third. God doesn't have a physical body. In human minds, we're used to think about most of the things, not everything, most of the things, in the way they are found actually in our lives, in our bodies, in our world, so to speak. There are certain things that we understand also that are abstract, like love. You cannot touch love. You can do actions that express love, but you can't touch it. So we can actually deal with abstract ideas also. But the idea of God does not include at all a body. I put the picture of a body, but to be on purpose, so to speak. God doesn't have a body at all. What does it mean that God doesn't have a body? It means that nothing happens to him. What does it mean to happen to him? Nothing that happens to bodies actually happens to God. He does not stand, he doesn't sit, he doesn't sleep, he doesn't wake up, he doesn't, nothing that happens to us. Why do I go to sleep? Because I'm tired. My body is tired, like my soul is never tired. So my body is tired for whatever reason, and I need to go to sleep. My body is hungry for whatever reason, I need to eat, etc., etc. I need to sit because I'm tired, I need to stand up because whatever. But God doesn't have a body, he doesn't get tired. He didn't get tired to in creating the world in 6 days, and the seventh day he had to rest. Oh, I'm so tired, I have to go rest. No, not at all. He created that idea of rest for us to rest, not for him. He wasn't tired. So since God doesn't have a body, nothing that happens to bodies actually happens to God. Immediately, the Rambam actually talks about this because it's an obvious thing. When you start reading the scriptures, you're going to find all kinds of things that happen to God. All kinds of things that he's watching us from above, that he's hearing us. Oh, really? How do you watch? Because you have eyes. How do you hear? Because you have ears, and so on. And he sits, actually, he's sitting in the heavens. Well, really? He's up and down? So the Rambam says the classical answer to this question is that every single attribute, every single occurrence, thing that happens to God is actually a borrowed term. It's not really happening this to God. Rather, we talk about God. This is called anthropomorphism. We're talking about God as if we were talking about ourselves. I need to sit down, so that means that God sits down also. Like, for instance, one small idea to understand this a little bit deeper. When a person sits down, what's going on is that his intellect is coming down. Or another idea, when a person sits, means that something actually, quote unquote, sit in your head. Now you understand this. Now you can relate to this because the idea sat in your head, so to speak. Ideas don't sit. So the same thing happens to God. He comes down into the world. That means that actually he has power even within the physicality of our world. And he sees us. What does that mean? He has eyes? No. He sees, but not with the eyes that we understand. I explained in a different class, I'm going to do this very briefly because I explained it already, but since we're dealing with this idea, so I'm going to share it. A deeper way of understanding this is the classical answer that the Rambam offers. God doesn't have a body, but he sees. He doesn't have eyes. It's just a borrowed term. Okay. Eyes, human beings have eyes, God doesn't have eyes. Classical answer. A deeper answer, a little bit more complicated. Actually, he really has eyes. And our eyes are only a representation of the true eyes that are God's eyes. Like when we say, the Torah says that God took us out of Egypt with extended arm. It doesn't have arms. What do I mean? Yeah, actually, it's the opposite. God has arms, and our arms are just an image, so to speak, a drawing, quote unquote, of the real arms that belong actually to God. How do we know What's the verse that tells us, teaches us, that God, this third principle, doesn't have any image and any body, etc., etc.? So the Torah says, because you didn't see any image. Moshe Rabbeinu is talking to the Jewish people before going into Eretz Israel, the land of Israel. And he says, when you received the Torah, you didn't see anything. So don't come to think that God has an image, has a body, etc., etc. That's the third principle. Let's go to number four and number five. Some I put together because they're shorter, so to speak, in the text of the Rambam. That doesn't mean that they're shorter in understanding, but whatever. Principle number four is that God is eternal. What does that mean? God is not limited by time. He's not limited to time. The next I wrote there, time itself is a creation. The Rambam doesn't say this. I'm putting in this because it's a classical Hasidic thought. The Magid of Mezrich, the second Hasidic master after Baal Shem Tov, who was the founder of the Hasidic movement, he brought this idea in, like, time itself is a creation. What does that mean? Imagine in a scientific experiment, any experiment, scientifically speaking, has to have a moment that it begins and a moment that it ends. Because you have to evaluate the results of your experiment in a specific amount of time. Once you have a specific amount of time, you can extrapolate and say, okay, if in this time this happened, in more time this is going to happen, and so on. This is like classical science. In that model, so to speak, of a scientific experiment, the scientist is beyond, quote unquote, beyond the time that he assigns to his experiment. Let's say he brings, I don't know, two ants into a place, into a thing, whatever. And he puts the ants and he plays with the ants and he gives them food and this and that. And he's going to evaluate what happens to the ants in 1 month after being brought into this place and being given food in this way, in that way, et cetera, et cetera. So he starts counting the days. After a month, he says, oh, look, there are 10 ants, whatever. I'm making up, I don't know about ants. We have 10 ants, so we can say that in a period of a month, the ants multiplicate, they reproduce themselves, etc., etc. The scientist is, quote unquote, God in that experiment, and he is beyond that month. Because, of course, if he's a scientist that is evaluating something, anything that is evaluating, he's older, I mean, more than a month older, of course, otherwise he was a baby. He wouldn't be doing any experiments. So he's beyond that amount of time. It's insignificant for him, that amount of time. And if between a human being, a regular human being, in an experiment, it's that way, that a human being can be so beyond the time that he assigns to his experiment, so let's take that to God. God is infinitely beyond the time he assigns to us to, quote unquote, his experiments, his creation to bring his presence down here in the earth, etc., etc. One more idea to explain this. There's a classical question in Kabbalah. If God is good, why didn't God create the world before? Like the world has only a certain amount of years, 5,784 years. Why not more and be more good? And the answer is because God created time. He's not subjected to time. He creates time. He's beyond time, outside of time. That means eternity. Can we understand this? The truth is no. We can deal with this like intellectually speaking. We can understand that there's such a thing as eternity, but can we feel it and live it? The answer is no, because we are finite. We live within time. How do you know, in the fourth principle, how do you know that God is eternal? Because the verse says, from his abode, me'oina elokei kedem, that's the verse itself, from his abode, from his house, so to speak, God is eternal. So the Torah itself is saying that God is eternal. That's principle number four. Let's go to principle number five. God is the only one that is appropriate, makes sense, so to speak, to serve. Nothing else. Serve means to pray to him, to praise him, to do his commandments, fulfill his commandments. The only one that makes sense To serve is God. Why? Because the only one that has true, absolute, complete free will is God. Does that mean that we don't have free will? No, 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 no. Don't misunderstand. Free will is a whole deep concept in Judaism, in philosophy. The Rambam talks about this also, and then in this book that we're learning, so to speak, this part of the book that we're learning, it speaks about this in different places, but we do have free will. But the only one that actually decided to start this whole thing, even before we existed, it was God. And why did he do this? Because he has the real free will. He wanted this world, and he wanted us in his world, revealing his presence, etc., etc. So why should you serve anything else that is not more than a creation? Doesn't really have free will. This gives a like an introduction to the next concept, intermediaries. One of the things that Rambam emphasizes in this fifth principle is there's no such a thing as an intermediary between God and man, creation. Man, woman, everything is the same, as I mentioned many times. There's no intermediaries. They shouldn't pray to something else in order to, whatever, have sustenance or have health or whatever you want. Doesn't make any sense, because anything else doesn't really have free will. God is deciding everything that's going on, that is not going on, and so on. So this principle means that, again, the only one we should actually contemplate whether we should fulfill his commandments or not, of course we should, but I'm saying God decided to give us free will to decide whether we want to do it or not. Okay, we want to do it and we're going to do it, etc., etc. But the only one that makes sense whether to decide whether we should do it or not is God. If I give you a commandment, you can argue and you can say, wait, Tuvia saying things like this, like that, I think in a different way. What's the problem? If you bring proofs to your way of thought, okay, maybe you're right, and maybe I'm wrong, and I could be perfectly be wrong. I'm a human being. I make many mistakes. God doesn't make any mistake. There's no such a thing. Even when we don't like what it does, but it's not a mistake. He's coming to teach us something, etc., etc. This is what it means that the only one appropriate to serve is God. This principle that Rambam says that is based on the idea of the prohibition of idolatry, because the real meaning, it's a deep thing, but the real meaning of idolatry is that there's something else in creation, or a person considers that there's something else in creation important, maybe just as God, maybe even more than God, God forbid. But this is what it means, idolatry. For instance, give you a very, very basic, low, ordinary example, but it's an example at the end of the day. If comes Shabbat, we shouldn't do many kinds of works, 39 melachos in types of works, etc., etc. I'm not going to go into a whole class of Shabbos now, of Shabbat. And the final game of your favorite sport that you love so much is in Shabbos. Now you have to decide whether you're going to see the game and desecrate Shabbos, Chas v'Shalom, God forbid, or you say, no, God is more important than this game. Even though I gave my life for this game and I love this game and I love this team and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But God said you should not be doing this now. We can argue whether it's a prohibition from the Torah, a prohibition from our sages. Okay, that's a different argument. I'm not going to go into that. This is not a class on Shabbos. It's just an example. What's your main value? What's your main priority? God or whatever you like? That's the essence, in a nutshell, of idolatry. When a person considers that something, anything, can be a sport, can be myself, can be my whatever, anything, more important than God, that's called idolatry. It's a very subtle thing, but it's something to think about and to contemplate and to have it in your mind. So basically, Why I'm bringing this is because the Rambam says, look, this fifth principle is based on the idea of idolatry, and there are so many verses talking about the prohibition of idolatry, I don't need to bring you a verse. That's what the Rambam says. Forget it. Go look in the Torah. It's full of verses against idolatry. In the Ten Commandments, in Parshas Yisro, in Parshas Vayeshanan, in Parshas Re'eh, it's full of the prohibition of idolatry. Let's move on. Principles 6 and 7. The Rambam talks a lot about this. Even so, I put them together in order to... I should have put them separate in two different slides. But I on purpose put them together because I wanted to show you the difference between the 6th principle and the 7th. That when you read the text, the original text of Rambam, you see the difference. But it's important to understand because if we don't dwell on the difference, we don't really understand the 7th principle. So let's go to the 6th. Let's start from the beginning, so to speak. Prophecy. The 6th principle of the Rambam is that there's such a thing as prophecy. What does prophecy mean? Prophecy means that God gives knowledge to human beings. This knowledge comes directly from him. What I mean directly means that not that God is talking to you. I mean, God sending angels or messengers, whatever the case is, to give a specific person, can be man, can be a woman. There were so many prophets in Jewish history. I don't remember the exact number that the Talmud quotes, but it's around tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands. I don't remember exactly the number. You'll forgive me, but we're talking about lots of them. However, when you see the Tanakh, the Bible, so to speak, you have only a certain number of prophets. Yeah, I remember if it's 14, 15, maybe 16, 17. I don't remember exactly, but not tens of thousands. Why is that? Because most of the prophecies were not necessary to be registered for next generations. Like, for instance, there's a story in the Tanakh, in the book of Shmuel, that when Shaul, who was not yet a king, he was an important guy, whatever, but he wasn't king, Shaul was searching for donkeys that his father lost. Whatever, he had a few donkeys and they got lost. So Shaul went out to search for the donkeys of his father and he couldn't find the donkeys. They were lost. So a guy that was together with Shaul told him, look, let's go to Shmuel, who is a prophet, and he will tell you where your donkeys are. So we see from this story, very small story, that there was a prophecy. I mean, Shmuel was a huge, huge important person in the history of the Jewish people, in the history of the world, whatever. There's a whole book of Shmuel, Shmuel Aleph, Shmuel Beis, first book, second book, whatever. Shmuel was an important guy. One of the jobs, so to speak, of Shmuel was, hey, prophet, I lost my donkeys. Can you tell me where they are? So the prophet, whatever. Oh, yeah, your donkeys are, you know what? In such and such field, in such and such place. It looks like something so unimportant. So that's why certain prophecies, most of them, were not recorded, were not registered. And most of the prophets, we don't even know their names. And furthermore, there are certain prophets that we know their names and their prophecies are not registered. For instance, there's a story of Nasan Anovi, Prophet Nasan. He lived in the times of David Amelech. Nasan, God Anovi. They were, I think it was God. I think it was God, I don't remember, or whatever. I think it was called God. But there are certain prophets, again, we know they existed. Huldah Hanevia, it was a woman. There were many, many prophets. We don't know what they said, but they existed. Now, again, the principle itself, number 6, is that God gives prophecy to human beings. Now, this doesn't happen to everybody. At least it didn't happen to me yet. I don't think it's going to happen either. But whatever. What are the conditions for a person, man or woman, to be considered a prophet? What are the conditions? The Rambam quotes a few of them, and I actually copied this from a different book. But I thought it was important to understand, in order to have tools also, if anybody, there's a Mishnah, there's a teaching of our sages in the ethics of our fathers, Pirkei Avos. Dama shitoshiv l'apikoros. You should have an answer to people that come question things in Torah. You should have answers. You should know the answers. Okay, we don't know the answer to everything, and it's okay. You can say, I don't know. It's not a problem. But at least one should try to have certain answers. So one of the things that Rambam explains in this book, Mishneh Torah, not in the book that we're learning, in a different book, is precisely what are the conditions for a prophet, to be considered a prophet. I didn't write everything because of this many chapters, but within the conditions are, it has to be a wise person, has to control his emotion. If he gets angry, if he gets depressed, forget it, he's not a prophet. Has to have really big and ample understanding of things, has to know the mystical things of Torah, has to sanctify himself or herself, separates from earthly matters, earthly thing, things like a prophet is not a guy that is sitting in doing videos in YouTube. Forget it. He's not a prophet. Prophets don't deal with YouTube and with internet and with... No. Prophets are very, very special people. Do we have prophecy today? That's an argument. The Talmud says we don't. In Soita, at the end of Soita, and the tractate Soita, the Talmud says clearly we don't have prophecy today. But there are certain different levels of prophecy. Not everything is the same. So you can say that today we also have prophets, but in a different level, not like they used to be, that Ishaya Hanovi, one of the highest prophets, etc., they used to stand and start talking, and then the words of God were coming out of their mouth, literally. Okay. The Rambam says that this particular principle, number six, that God gives prophecy to human beings, which, between parentheses, I showed you before. Let's go back a little bit, just a second. You'll see this is interesting. In this slide, you see three principles of Rabbi Yosef Alboy. One of them is prophecy. He says this is something really. You can imagine again. Rabbi Yosef Alboy is not arguing with the Rambam, saying you don't know what you're talking about. Judaism, there's no such a thing as no. He's saying whatever you're saying is not a principle. It's not fundamental. However, there are three things that are indeed fundamental. One of them is prophecy. One of them is prophecy. Let's go. Oops. Okay. Okay, so let's go back. Principle number six. The Rambam says, I don't need to bring you verses to prove the idea of prophecy, because you go read the whole Torah, is talking about prophets. And you have the books of prophets, etc., etc. Now, let's go to principle number seven. I wrote it very, very short, but it's a very important principle. And actually, one of the things that is the sources, so to speak, fundamentals of Judaism, besides what the Rambam says, this is one of them, the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu. One of the things, I didn't write it down, I'm explaining, so to speak, outside the text itself. One of the things of a prophet, how do you really distinguish whether a person is a prophet or not? I can sit here and say, look, this is going to happen, blah, blah, blah. Am I a prophet or not? Okay, the way to prove that a prophet is right is that whatever he says is going to happen actually happens. And not just once. One time, and second time, and the third time, and many times. The Rambam writes this language. Many, many times we prove the prophet. And every single thing that he says is going to happen actually happens. Not that close to what he said. No. Exactly what he said. This is what happened. This is the way to prove that a certain person is a prophet. And again, Rambam says you have to prove him many times until you actually can say this guy, whatever he says, happens. So this guy is a prophet. Okay. But Moshe Rabbeinu is different. Why do we believe in Moshe Rabbeinu? Not because he made miracles, not because he was a good guy. No. We believe in Moshe Rabbeinu because this is the fundament of Judaism, because we, quote unquote, I'll explain this word later, we saw him talking to God. We saw God, and we heard God talking to him. And after God spoke with him, he came to us and said, God says, such and such. Yeah, actually, we just heard that. So because in the giving of the Torah, we saw, we heard God talking to Moshe, to Moses, and giving him certain commandments, and we heard this, we saw this, we understood this. And then Moshe came to us and said, look, this God said this and this and that. That's why we believe in Moshe Rabbeinu. In other words, the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu, and this is the seventh principle, it's much higher than the prophecy of any other prophet. Any other prophet. Even when the Rambam is defining, we're going to learn this later, but when the Rambam is defining Moshiach, what's Moshiach? Moshiach, the anointed, whatever, the one we're waiting for, etc., etc., he's going to be a prophet also. However, the Rambam says, not as high as Moshe Rabbeinu. Korev, the Rambam says, Korev le Moshe Rabbeinu, close to Moshe Rabbeinu. What is the Rambam saying? The Rambam saying, look, there was and there will be no prophet as Moshe Rabbeinu. This is one of the principles of Judaism, that we have a guy that anything he said came directly from God. And how do you see this difference? So I wrote down what the Rambam brings about the difference between Moshe Rabbeinu and the rest of the prophets. All the prophets, all of them, no exception, they did not talk directly to God. They spoke, as I explained before, through angels. Came an angel and gave a vision to the prophet. And the prophet saw this vision in sleeping or not sleeping, sometimes at night, sometimes during the day, whatever. The prophet saw the vision. Sometimes the prophet saw the vision and the explanation for the vision, because sometimes the angels, because God commanded so, the angels spoke in like in riddles to the prophets. And if you actually read Yehezkel, and if you read Hosea, there are certain prophecies that you say, wow, what is God doing over here? God tells Hosea, one of the prophets, to go marry whatever, a woman of those that work at night, etc., etc. You say, wow, this guy was a prophet, was a holy guy, and God is telling him to do. And if you read Yehezkel, God tells him, lay down on your right side, lay down on your left side, pick up a piece of wood, and then you say, what is this? What is this whole thing? Did it really happen? There are two opinions, actually. Some people say that whatever the prophet is saying actually happened. Hosea got married to this woman and had children, etc., etc. And some people say, no, this is a prophetic vision. And again, sometimes the prophetic vision comes together with the explanation, and sometimes not. For instance, Yehezkel saw the third temple, and it's described in the book of Yehezkel. However, and this is what the Talmud says, not that I'm saying this, we don't understand exactly what Yehezkel was talking about. We don't know it. So the things we understood from the temple that Yehezkel saw, we used them to build the second temple after the destruction of the first temple. But the thing we didn't understand, we don't understand what he's talking about. So he saw the vision, he wrote it down, but I don't know, I don't even know if he understood what he saw. Maybe he didn't write it properly. I don't know, whatever. He wrote the words of God. But the point is that sometimes we have the vision just by itself. Sometimes we just have the understanding of the vision. And sometimes we have both. But none of them actually spoke to God. Moshe Rabbeinu spoke to God. And we heard again Moshe Rabbeinu speaking to God. Second point, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't see visions, didn't understand the messages of God through visions. No. Directly, a clear message. And we see this in the Torah. God tells Moshe Rabbeinu, go tell the Jews to do this and that. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, okay, I'm going. Go do this and that. Not like a riddle and you have to try to understand what did God mean? No. Clear messages. The prophets, as I explained before, sometimes saw clear messages, sometimes not. Third point, very interesting point. All the prophets, all of them, when they received the prophecy, they lost control of themselves. They fell into the floor and they started like epileptic movements. Some of them, actually, the Tanakh says, some of them took out the clothes, like became new. They went like crazy. they were receiving a prophecy. Actually, in the Tanakh, the prophets are called meshuga, crazy guys. Yeah, they're all the crazy guys. They're all nuts. Why? Because when they received the prophecy, they behaved like nuts. Then they recovered, so to speak, themselves, and they, whatever, got close and shared the prophecy when it was for sharing. Because some prophecies were not for sharing. Well, whatever the case is, Moshe Rabbeinu was not like that. Just as I'm sitting over here speaking to you, Moshe Rabbeinu spoke to God. No problem. And God spoke with him, and he didn't lose control of himself, of his body, etc. And the last point, Moshe Rabbeinu, whenever he had a doubt, whenever he wanted to prophesize, I mean, talk to God, so to speak, he did it. So to speak, he had the red phone. Hello, God? Yeah, what do I do with this? Oh, yeah, okay, thank you, bye. And he, whatever, acted upon that. All the other prophets were not like that. No way. They could not decide when to receive the prophecy. They got prepared for prophecy. The Rambam quotes the idea of singing. They sung songs and they were happy and they were going around and dancing, etc. And maybe God gives them prophecy. And maybe not. Maybe you prepared your whole life for prophecy and you didn't get it. I'm sorry. Moshe Rabbeinu, whenever he wanted, of course, whenever God wanted, also contacted Moshe and told him ideas. Of course, of course. But what I'm saying is the other way around. When Moshe wanted, he got messages from God. That's the four ideas, so to speak, the Rambam quotes, where we see that Moshe Rabbeinu was way, way beyond all the other prophets. And this is the seventh principle of Judaism, the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu. Number 8 and 9, also very, very important, very interesting, important. Torah is divine. What does it mean the Torah is divine? It means that the Torah comes from God. And this is one of the things, as I spoke before, Rav Yosef Alboy, says this is one of the three principles, the true, so to speak, three principles of Judaism. Torah is divine. That means comes from heavens. It's not something that somebody wrote. It's not something that a group of people came up with, or whatever case you, people say, scholars in universities learn the Torah and say, no, five guys wrote this. There's a guy called Avaye, there's a guy called Elohim, there's a guy that was a priest, there's a guy that was a Levite. In Yiddish we say Bobe Mises, stories of the grandmother. No way. Torah is divine. This is what Jews believe. Again, it's a belief. We have no proof to that, intellectually speaking. It's a belief. You can find, and it's okay, and it's fine, it's interesting, many places in the Torah that show you that this is something divine. That it could never have happened or could never have been expressed in such a way if it wouldn't come from God. Okay, it's interesting, and I'm not against that. It's interesting to find, but there's no real proof to that. Like, for instance, there's something called the Bible codes or something like that. It might sound interesting, and it's okay, but it's not something that really proves that the Torah is divine. And also, and this is very important, it's not something that proves to be true, even though it's very interesting, but it's not true. What do I mean? For instance, they put the whole text of the Torah in like a matrix, something like that, and they start doing like finding words, and you can find words over there. Wow, it's online. It's very interesting. If you find, what happens if you find in one line Tuvia? In another line, whatever, Chaim Yankel, and in another line, kill him. Oh, so I told the saying that I should go kill Chaim Yankel. And I go kill Chaim Yankel. And of course, the police finds me and takes me to trial, and I'm found guilty. And I say, Your Majesty, can I say something in front of the judge? Yes. Look, there's a Bible codes. The Torah says, I have to kill Chaim Yankel. Forget it. No way. You're going to end up in jail. No way. Not because of the justice of the people. Because you're thinking wrong. There's no real proof to that idea is true. No way. Torah is divine. Yes, Torah is divine, but that doesn't mean that we can really understand really what that is. There's no one. The Rambam says a very interesting thing that also it's difficult to chew, so to speak, but it's very interesting. The Rambam says that there's no, what does it mean that Torah is divine? It means that every single letter, every single expression in the Torah comes from God. And that means that every single expression, every single thing is saint, has a sanctity, kedusha. Even the things we find superfluous, like what is this written for? The Rambam brings the idea that when the Torah is describing in Parshas Vayishlach, the end of Parshas Vayishlach, Torah is describing the descendants of Esav. And it brings all kinds of names and kinds of people and the Achus Leitan Timna. He says that the sister of Leitan, it's the name of a person, was called Timna. What do I care? What's the name of the sister of Leitan? Whatever, this happened thousands of years ago. Leitan passed away and Timna passed away, and it's really not relevant. However, says the Rambam, that verse is as saint, as kodesh, as Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Shem Echad. Oh, what a nice verse, that God is one, it's so important. Yeah, it's the same. This is what it means, that the whole Torah comes from heaven, everything. And one step further, not just the written Torah, so to speak, but the oral Torah is also divine. Both written and oral Torah are divine. What does that mean? That the explanation of every single part of the Torah, because if you only have the written Torah, you don't really understand how to fulfill the commandments and what the Torah is really saying. That's called explanation. The oral Torah is as divine as the written Torah. And if a person negates this, he's actually negating the whole Torah. The Rambam says this very clearly. It's actually negating the whole Judaism. You can, of course, and we're going to talk about this in a few minutes, but you can, of course, argue our tradition, our custom is to do this and that. Okay, that's fine. I'm going to explain this in a minute. But that doesn't mean that the explanation that our sages offer on different verses, on different commandments, etc., it's made up by them. No way. No way. Even though we have different customs, etc., etc., as I'll explain in a minute. But those explanations are also divine. And I'm sorry. The Rambam brings a verse to prove this idea. When this verse comes from Parshas Koirach. Parshas Koirach is a very interesting Parsha. When actually Koirach was a cousin of Moshe Rabbeinu, and he rebelled against Moshe Rabbeinu. I'm not going to explain the whole Koirach story right now. It's not the point. It's not the point now. But the important point is that after the rebellion of Moshe of Koirach against Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron HaKohen, etc., etc., Moshe offered a solution to this rebellion. And Moshe basically said, look, if I'm right and Koirach is wrong, so let the earth open from below Koirach and shoot the earth, swallow Koirach. Let the earth swallow Koirach. And if I'm not, if I'm wrong and he's right, so I should pass away, whatever. And Moshe Rabbeinu ends up his words saying basically what the Rambam is quoting over here. Then you'll know that God sent me. Then you'll know that anything I do and anything I say and explain is not my idea. It's not coming from me. Both the things that are written and the things that are oral that I'm explaining to you how things should be done, God sent me. That's the proof that Rambam brings to explain that the oral Torah is also divine. Okay, that's principle number 8. Let's go to principle number 9. Torah, it's eternal and won't change. Because it is divine and God doesn't change, and God is eternal, Torah is also eternal and it doesn't change. What does it mean it doesn't change? The Rambam brings a verse that there's actually a commandment, one of the 613 commandments, we cannot add to the Torah and we cannot take from the Torah. What does that mean? I cannot, and a prophet, even a prophet, I'm not a prophet, but even a prophet cannot come up with a new commandment. Oh, from now on, there are 614 commandments. I'm adding a new one. What's the new commandment? To drink water from a blue glass. Oh, okay. I'm fulfilling a new commandment. No. There's no such a thing. Impossible. The Torah has 613 commandments, and that's it. Not more, not less. This is what it means, basically, that the Torah doesn't change and one will never change. Always be the same. After all, this is, the Rambam doesn't say this. I'm adding up this. After all, the Torah is God's wisdom. And God doesn't change. He says, it's actually a verse. Ani avayi lo shonis, I'm God, I didn't change. Therefore, his wisdom also doesn't change. And if the Torah is the wisdom of God, the Torah doesn't change. Commandments are always going to be commandments and are always going to be the same, etc., etc. Now, one point that I'm adding up is not in the principles, and it basically we finished the ninth principle, but I thought it was an important and an interesting thing to explain. In Judaism, there are many, many kinds of customs and traditions. Basically, and I'm really, really being basic because this is not the main point of this class. Basically, you have Ashkenazim and Sephardim. Basically, within Ashkenazim, you have many kinds of customs and traditions. Within Sephardim, you have, and there are also Taimanim and Mizrahim, etc., etc. But I'm being very, very basic over here. I want to emphasize this, so nobody should be offended. There are other traditions also, and important, holy, etc., etc. Basically. Ashkenazic and Sephardic. Ashkenazic, they come from Europe, Eastern Europe, and Sephardim come usually from Spain, from Syria, from different places. Okay, Mizrahim, Taimanim, okay. Again, there are other traditions. So then you're going to ask me, wait a second, which one is the correct one? Which one is the true one? And if a rabbi comes to me and says, no, we do things this way, and the other rabbi that you also appreciate says, no, we do things in a different way. Who's right? Who's wrong? Apparently, there are many Torahs, many Bibles, many Judaisms. And it seems, looks funny, looks strange, and looks also interchangeable, so to speak. Because with time, different traditions became actually traditions. And before that specific thing was a tradition, actually, it didn't exist. For instance, simple example. There's a part of the prayers called Aleinu Leshabeach. Most of the customs is to finish the prayers, the morning and the afternoon and the night prayers, with this prayer, actually, with this thing called Aleinu Leshabeach. And it's written by at least the first few verses, very, very few first verses, by Yeshua bin Nun, the leader of the Jewish people that actually went into the land of Israel with the Jewish people after the passing of Moshe Rabbeinu, Yeshua. The tradition is that Yeshua wrote, Aleinu Leshabeach, Adonai Kohel, etc. We should praise, upon us is to praise God, etc., etc., to the master of everything, etc., etc. Okay. So what happened? How did people pray before Yeshua? There was not such a thing as Aleinu Leshabeach. And how did people pray actually before this prayer of Yeshua actually got into the Siddur, into the prayer book? So probably people didn't say that. Probably in the times of the Beis Hamikdash of the temple, people didn't say this. At some point in history, don't ask me when, I don't know, but at some point this became a tradition. So Judaism changes, Torah changes. Because before we didn't have this tradition, now we have this tradition. And the same thing happens with Ashkenazi and Sephardim. Before such a division existed, because there was a time that such a division did not exist, there were no Jews basically in Eastern Europe, and no Jews were Sephardic in Spain, whatever. Everybody was together in the Eretz Israel, in the land of Israel. So there was no such a thing as this tradition, that tradition. It was just one thing. So at some point, something, quote unquote, changed. And Rambam says that the Torah never changes. But it does change. The explanation is very simple. The fundamentals of the commandments do not change and will never change. Some details, oh yes, there are customs and traditions. Certain Jews do things in one way, certain Jews do things in a different way, and the Talmud itself says, Eilu ve'eilu divrei Elokim chayim. Both this way and that way are the words of the living God and are true and are holy, etc., etc. And it's a whole big thing to explain how actually both traditions are true. Okay, it's for a different class. But the point is that, again, we're talking of here, the principle of Judaism is that the fundamentals are always the same. Kashrus, the laws of what can you eat, what cannot eat, every single Jew, Orthodox, whatever, Hasidic, not Hasidic, every single Jew in the world has exactly the same rules. The fundamentals of the rules are the same. Some details, traditions, that might change. Yes. And might even change with time. Yes, it can change. At a certain time, we do things in one way. At a different time, we do things in a different way. I mean, time in history. 2,000 years ago, we did things one way. 2,000 years ago, afterwards, we do things in a different way. That's okay. Because the fundamental is the same. Things didn't change. The verses didn't change. The commandments, the mitzvot didn't change. What changes is, again, circumstances, different details on how to do certain things. As long as those details, those quote-unquote changes come from a holy place, they're fine. How do you decide whether they come from a holy place or not? Because big authorities, rabbinic authorities, say, actually, this is a tradition. This comes from that, because I say something, it doesn't become a tradition. No way. I'm not an authority. I'm nobody. So because certain authorities, historic authorities, that all the Jewish people actually relates to these people as authorities, and everybody accepts that this guy is an authority, when this guy says something, that could become a tradition. But not because every rabbi says something, it suddenly is a tradition. And one more point that I think is important, even though it's not part of the principle itself, just to finish this idea, it does not make any sense at all to mix customs and traditions. No way. No way. If Sephardic Jews do things in a certain way, that's holy and pure, again, as long as it's based on the traditions of the great authorities, etc., etc., that's holy and that's good for Sephardic Jews. If an Ashkenazi Jew does certain things in a certain way because the tradition is ta-ta-ta-ta, that's okay. But you cannot mix them. It doesn't make sense. No. You can choose which path you want to live with. Okay, you can follow the traditions of your forefathers, or you can make up your become, so to speak, not make up, become part of a certain community and adopt the traditions of that community. You don't like that community, go to a different community, leave this community and become part of a different community. No problem to that. No problem with that. There are certain rules. You always have to go up in the holiness of traditions, you cannot go down, but okay, certain rules there are. But you could, so to speak, change it. But don't mix them. Mixing is the wrong place. Because when you mix and you don't really know what you're doing, you could end up with traditions that actually contradict themselves. You can end up with a tradition of doing certain things in one way, because it represents a specific thing. And you mix it with some other tradition that actually represents the exact opposite. And you feel, oh, this is so nice. I dress this way and that way. Oh, I like this dressing. Yeah, but you know what? You're representing actually two opposite things. You're doing something wrong. Okay, let's go. Move on. Principles number 10 and 11. God knows the actions of men. God understands, this is simple, it's not such a deep thing. God understands what people do, what people speak, what people think. Different, I call it these two verses from Yehezkel and Yirmiyahu, because actually the Rambam calls this, don't think like those, Yehezkel is representing those people that think that God left the earth. God doesn't really care about anything that goes on down here. Don't think like that. It's wrong. God cares and he knows exactly what's going on over here. Rather, the proper mindset, so to speak, is this is another verse from Yirmiyahu. The eyes of God are open, your eyes are open to the ways of men. That means he knows what we do, clearly knows what we do. And the absolute conclusion, the next part of this, the next principle, but it's related to this previous one, reward and punishment. And again, I'm going back on purpose quickly. Rabbi Yosef Albo, in the end of this slide, this is the third principle he brings, the third one. Reward and punishment, number 11 in the Rambam's principles. There's a thing that is called the world to come, and God rewards people, the good deeds of people, with either the world to come or in this world, and God punishes the deeds of people, when they're wrong, of course, in this world and in the world to come. This is a very important principle of Judaism. Now, the proof I'm going to explain in a minute. I wanted to just point out, not that the Rambam talks about this, not in this place, in a different place he talks about it, but I wanted to point out that what does it mean the world to come? Like when we started this class, I explained that the Rambam is introducing us to a specific chapter in Tractate Sanhedrin of the Mishnah, 10th chapter, that talks about actually the world to come. And talks who has the world to come, who doesn't have the world to come. So there's a whole argument, like philosophical argument, what is the world to come? It's not so simple. The Rambam has his own view of what the world to come is. And for the Rambam, the world to come is a spiritual world, like the end of times, so to speak, where there's not going to be a body, we're not going to be living in this earth, rather, we're going to be like spiritual things. The Rambam calls them sichlim nivdalim, the separated intellects. That's exact words of the Rambam, separate intellects. What does that mean? I don't know. You can go ask the Rambam. He's buried in Tiberia, in Eretz Israel, in the land of Israel. But the main point of the idea is, for the Rambam, the world to come is a spiritual thing, just that. And not to be confused with the Gan Eden, with the paradise. Basically, very basically, we have the life in this world. We are alive, Baruch Hashem. God is good with us, and we are alive. When a person passes away, goes through a period of purification, etc. I'm not going to go into the details of that. And then he goes into Gan Eden. Gan Eden is the paradise, where what are people doing in paradise? Studying Torah, learning about God, perceiving God, etc., etc. That's the paradise. Okay. After that, when Mashiach comes, there's going to be this is the Rambam's opinion, okay? It's going to be a period of time where there's going to be life in this earth. And Mashiach is going to do a certain amount of things that we're going to learn in a minute, in a few minutes. And then, after that period of times of Mashiach, everybody's going to pass away. We're going to resurrect, as we're going to learn in a few minutes. And then again, everybody's going to pass away, forget it, spiritual life. The end of times, so to speak, is constant and eternal spiritual life, perceiving God, understanding God, knowing Torah, etc. This is the opinion of the Rambam, Maimonides. The Ramban, Nachmanides, he lived around 100 years after the Rambam, in Spain also. He has a different opinion. And why am I bringing this? Because the truth is that Kabbalah, Hasidism, mysticism follows in this particular thing the opinion of the Ramban, Nachmanides. pay attention that I wrote Rambam with a with an M at the end, or Ramban with an N of nothing at the end. Two different guys. That's why I wrote also Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman. That's the Ramban. Rambam and Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon. Now we're learning these principles of the Rambam. But the Ramban, in this particular idea of the world to come, has a different setup. He says like this, basically. There's life in this world that we're living right now. When a person passes away, goes through a period of refinement, etc., goes to Gan Eden. Then Mashiach comes. When Mashiach comes, there's going to be a period of Mashiach doing a certain amount of things that we're going to learn in a minute. Then everybody's going to resurrect. All the dead people are going to resurrect. And that's going to be a stage of eternal life. Eternal physical life in this earth as we know it, but in a more refined way, in an eternal way. The body's not going to get whatever. It's not going to become old, so to speak, whatever. No diseases, no nothing. That's going to be an eternal period of knowing God, understanding God, learning about God, etc., etc. So the main difference between the Rambam and the Ramban is what's going to be the quote-unquote the end. How does this finish? How does this whole story finishes? For the Rambam, the whole story finishes in a spiritual way. For the Ramban, this whole story finishes in a physical way. In this earth as we know it. Okay, this is the world to come. What is called generally the world to come. Now, what's the proof? What's the proof of this idea of reward and punishment? It's very interesting. The whole Parshas Bechukoisai. In Parshas Bechukoisai, in the third book of Torah, the end of the third book of the Torah says clearly, "In Bechukoisai Teilechu, if you follow my commandments, I'm going to give you rain in the proper time, and the land is going to be give the produce." Like, it's pretty clear. However, pretty clear that there's such a thing as reward and punishment. If you behave properly, I'm going to reward you. And the Torah says, if not, I'm going to give you all kinds of things, all kinds of punishments. However, when the Rambam is proving, so to speak, bringing the proof from verses of this principle of reward and punishment, he doesn't quote Parshas Bechukoisai. No, he brings a story. It's very interesting. He brings a story. What's the story? This story is recorded in Parshas Kisisa, in the middle of the second book of the Torah, Parshas Kisisa. In Parshas Kisisa, we find the whole long, long story of the Chet Ha'Egel, the golden calf, the whole story is the golden calf. I'm not going to go through the whole story, forget it, not for now, but one small detail. When Moshe was arguing, so to speak, with God, go forgive these people. Don't forgive these people. I'm going to destroy everybody. I'm going to kill everybody, says God. And Moshe says, now, wait a second. If you kill everybody, erase me from your book. I don't want to be named. I don't want this book to be named on me that I'm here and I didn't ask for them. Forget it. If you kill everybody because they did the golden calf, erase me. Delete me. Don't put my name in your book. And God says to Moshe, well, wait a second. I'm going to delete or erase, whatever, the names of those who sinned. And those who didn't sin, I'm not going to do anything. They don't deserve it. This is the proof that the Rambam brings. You see, first of all, God knows pretty well who sinned and who didn't sin. And he himself is saying, I'm going to punish those who sinned. Why? Because I'm going to erase them from my book. The whole story right now doesn't really matter. The whole story of the golden calf, etc. But it's interesting how the Rambam says, you see, clearly God is saying, I know who sinned. I know the people that actually serve the golden calf, prepare the golden calf, etc., etc. So why should I punish everybody? You're right, Moshe Rabbeinu. I'm not going to punish everybody. I'm just going to punish those who sinned. Oh, there you go. There's a principle of reward and punishment. Okay, let's go to the last two principles. First, I'm going to say it very quickly, and then we're going to go to the details. The last two principles are the idea of Mashiach. Mashiach means a person. I'm going to read the details in a minute. It's a person that comes to redeem the not just the Jewish people, but the whole humanity, and bring the revelation of God, bring this end, quote unquote, end of times. So actually, the eternal end of time, so to speak. Or like the Rambam says, spiritually speaking, or like the Ramban says, materially speaking, okay, you can go either way, yeah, whatever way you want. But that's Mashiach. It's a person, it's a man, human being, with all kinds of conditions, as we're going to learn in a minute. That's principle number 12. There's no Judaism without Mashiach. And the Rambam even says that a person should await Mashiach constantly and should think about this every day. And even we say in prayer every day, three times a day, Vishwascha kivinu kol hayom. We say to God, your salvation, we are awaiting the whole day. I mean, not just every day. Like every day, I think, yeah, it's a Mashiach. Oh, yeah, right. That's it. I fulfilled my commandment. I thought about Mashiach for 3 seconds every day. No, no, no. Kol hayom means the whole day. How do you live like that? Okay, we can make a class on Mashiach, but this is the proper set of mind, so to speak. Yeshuascha kivinu kol hayom. The whole day we're waiting for this. And of course, if you're waiting for this the whole day, it means every day, the whole day. Okay, that's Mashiach. Very, very briefly. The last, we're going to go into details in a minute. The last principle, number 13, is, as I explained before, resurrection of death, of the dead. In the text, the original text of the Rambam, he says this in one line. Really, really briefly, one line. And this, and actually, in the guide for the perplexed, which is a philosophical book of the Rambam, as I explained at the beginning of the class, he doesn't even mention this idea of resurrection of death. And the Rambam was so criticized for this, terribly criticized for this, to the point that some people wanted to say the Rambam doesn't believe in this. That's why he doesn't explain it. He just mentions it briefly. He doesn't really believe in this. He's a heretic himself. That's what some people used to say. That's why many years after writing this text, so to speak, that we're reading, we're learning, the Rambam wrote a whole long, very long epistle, whatever, a letter, talking specifically about the resurrection of the dead. Really long and complex, etc., etc. It's found in, you can find it in Sepharia, you're going to find it. But basically what the Rambam says over there, besides the idea of describing and whatever we know about it, because actually we don't know anything about it, very briefly, but the Rambam says, I did not write about these issues in this commentary on the Mishnah, in the Guide for the Perplexed. Basically, he says, I didn't write about it because we don't know the details. So what am I going to say? We don't understand how it's going to be. That's the truth. So that's why he didn't write it, not because he doesn't believe in this. Chas v'shal, God forbid. And in that letter, he brings the proof, so to speak, from a verse. It's in Daniel. That's the chapter 12, whatever. Daniel says clearly, Be'akitsu, I don't remember the whole verse right now, but Daniel says clearly the dead are going to rise up from their tombs and from their cave or whatever, from the place where they burial places, etc. So these are basically the principles. Let's go back a little bit to principle number 12 that I think is important to understand at least some details on what Mashiach is and what are the conditions for Mashiach. For a person to be considered Mashiach, these conditions, the Rambam doesn't bring them in this commentary that we're learning. He brings them in Mishneh Torah, and he says basically, I'm just going to read what is written over there because it's easier. First of all, Mashiach again is a man; it's a human being, a man and not a woman, and he's a descendant of King David and King Solomon. He, today, even today, we have families that have the tradition to be descendants of the tribe of Yehuda, which is the tribe of King David and King Solomon. Certain families have this tradition. It has to be a person that learns and strives in learning Torah, not just that he knows a few verses here, a few verses over there. He's really knowledgeable in Torah. He fulfills the commandments, the mitzvahs, according to the written Torah and the oral Torah, because both, as we explained before, are actually divine. So he keeps this, the complete, so to speak, Torah. He strengthens the Jewish people to follow the Torah, the oral Torah, the written Torah, etc., etc. He has to build the temple in Jerusalem. It doesn't mean that he has to build them with the hands. You know, it's impossible to build a whole temple with your hands and just alone. It means that he's the one, like the architect. He doesn't really build the whole building. He's the architect of the building, whatever. He's the guide that leads people to build the building. So he has to build the temple in Jerusalem, in the proper place, not anywhere else. And he has to gather all the dispersed Jewish people from all the places in the world. If this man does these ideas, these things, then we are certain this is Mashiach. If the person tries to do this, any person tries to do these things, but if he fails, then we're saying that this is not the Moshiach we're waiting. Maybe he was a tzaddik, a righteous person. Maybe he was a great guy. No problem to that. But it's not Moshiach because he didn't do this. Now, the Talmud itself discusses this. Very interesting in Sanhedrin. Can be a living person. Can be somebody that comes from the non-living people. The Talmud says this clearly. So not necessarily is a person that is alive today. Maybe he was alive, he passed away, and somehow, don't ask me why, hey, how, I'm sorry, don't ask me how, he's going to be Mashiach. I don't know. And there are so many different midrashim and works of our sages and opinions. We don't know how this is going to happen. That's the truth. But one last point, every single commandment has a definition. Because if you don't give a definition to a commandment, so you don't know whether you fulfill the commandment or not. Like, for instance, Pesach. Pesach is the festivity that we celebrate, that we went out of Egypt, and we have to eat matzah. That's what you said, Ba'erev Te'achlu Matzis. And the night of the 14th to the 15th of Nisan, you have to eat matzah. So you have to tell me, in order for me to know whether I fulfill or not the commandment, how much? What is matzah? What is considered this bread, whatever, and how much do I have to eat? A whole box? 3 boxes? 10 boxes? I don't know. A very small part? How much do I have to eat in order to fulfill the commandment? There has to be a clear, very clear definition. Otherwise, we don't know whether we fulfill or not. The same thing applies to Mashiach. There has to be a definition. And not that we chose this definition because we would like a guy that knows a lot of Torah. Yeah, it makes sense. No, I don't care. Okay, whatever. No. This is the definition of Mashiach. And any person that does not fit precisely with this definition, so it's not Mashiach. Again, maybe he was a great guy, Mazel Tov, so to speak. Very nice. But it's not Mashiach. It has to fit this definition. That's why the Rambam actually, again, clearly defines what is the Jewish Mashiach we're waiting for, the anointed, the whatever, that we're waiting for.